All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksicles? How are you? I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF. Welcome to the show. Very excited today. Michael Imperioli, Christopher, is on the show. I don't know if he likes that, but that's what he's known for. God damn it, I miss The Sopranos. Do you ever sit down and just think to yourself, fuck, I miss The Sopranos? Like, back in the day? I don't know if it was back in the day, but when they were on, it was really the first kind of show of its kind where you just looked forward to it. It was like a craving. You're like Sunday nights, you'd lock in and just, what's going to happen? I had no idea that was coming. That type of television, that sort of, I don't know if it's long form or serialized. I mean, there's nothing new about that. But just the fact that, like Breaking Bad that way too, that you enter every episode not knowing what the fuck is going to happen. And also the great characters. And Michael Imperioli, played a great character on that. And he was great in Goodfellas, and he's great in his movie. He's great. He's a great guy. And I was thrilled to talk to him. Because he's one of those guys, the character was so defined on The Sopranos, where you think, I'm going to talk to that guy. And he's not that guy. But it was great talking to him. It made me miss New York, you know. And I was just there. I didn't mention some stuff about New York. You know, as I go back, you know, I finally got some good weather. I think I told you that. And I went down. I lived there a long time. And on a nice day in New York City, there's really nothing that compares to it. There's nothing like New York. There's no comparing any other city or place or feeling to New York, because it is of itself, and it is amazing, huge, spectacular, moving, the best city. And I was talking to some guy, a cab driver of all people, because that's what you do in New York, right? But we were just talking about it, about how nothing feels like New York. You get in it, and when you're in it, you're filled with the energy of it. And if you know how to be there, it's there's nothing more exciting. Just a walk in New York City on a beautiful day. And there was a couple of moments there. You know, I was walking and I was in between things. I was there to meet with people for a thing, about a thing. I had like 2 hours. And I was just, it was almost like fall weather. And obviously, I went to Joe's and I had the slice and or two, maybe three. But don't, you know what I mean? I was on a trip. And I was wandering around and I literally had nothing to do. I was like, why don't I have anything to do? I'm in New York. Isn't there somebody I need to see? Isn't there someplace I need to go? And I was like, no, man, you're just in New York. You're just here. So I went to a place that's near and dear to my heart. I went to the secret meeting place at Perry Street and went back in time to the early days of the crazy clean time. Historical place, if you know what I'm talking about. Some of you do. If you don't, if you're in the secret society, be sure to go to Perry Street when you're in New York City. It's a classic. It's an institution. It's old timey, man. But I was with my producer, Brendan McDonald, my business partner in this endeavor, WTF. And, you know, we were downtown and we were at a meeting. We went to a meeting about a thing. And we were right there at the World Trade Center, at the site and at the new building. I had not seen the new building. And I had not seen the memorial. And I was there that day. I was in Queens on my roof, feeling obliterated and in shock. And I don't think I'd been down to that site, certainly not since it had been under construction. And maybe, you know, I'd gone down there weeks after the horror, where it was just a smoking pile of steel, mangled steel, that you couldn't really get close to, but you could see down the street. And I remember there was a lot of talk about what the memorial would be, what the new building would be, and everybody was chiming in about this or that. So I had been really out of the loop because I had left New York. But I felt compelled, and I felt like I needed to go see the memorial. I had no idea what it was going to be like, what effect it would have, how it could be effective. And it's it was amazing. It's an amazing memorial. It's literally the bottoms of the original towers. There's two of these pieces to this memorial, and it's just a giant square. It's a hole, and it's a waterfall on all four sides, and then there's a pool at the bottom, and then another square hole that you just, it's just darkness that you can't see the bottom of, and the water goes into it. All around the top are the names of the victims, and there are two of these, and they're massive, and they're quiet, and they're subtle, and they're profound, and they're moving. I didn't know how I would feel when I went down there, but to stand there and to have the reflection and to have, you know, to honor the dead and honor the memory of what happened there and the ongoing sort of heartache of that. You don't really realize it, that you have this heartache, this grief, until you check in with it. And there's something that was felt obviously around the world, but certainly if you lived in New York, it was a profound injury. And as I stood there, I was like, this, they did this right, man. I am moved. I am thinking back. I am elevated. And it was beautifully done. And it's something you should really see if you're in New York. Just no matter what you think about what happened, it happened. And people were killed that day. And it was horrible. But to really pay respect was no easy trick. And I don't even know who designed this thing. But to use the space of the towers that were once there and why they're gone and what that represents, and to integrate into that space a sense of living grief and respect for everyone who was lost there was no easy trick. No easy task, and it's a beautiful, beautiful piece of living memorial art. And the new tower is nice, gotta be honest. I didn't go up in it, but it's nice. It's hard to be there, but I'm glad I did. It definitely had the effect of bringing back something painful, of integrating the grief and of elevating the loss and sending it off and getting, it was a little bit of closure there. It was profound. I had no idea. I didn't know what to expect. You don't know how something like that's going to hit you, but obviously, there were those of us who were there, and it was, yeah, well, everyone knows it was, I'm not saying anything new. It was a tough day, but the memorial is spectacular, and I appreciate it. Also, a funny thing happened in NYC. I thought it was a classic thing. I was in a coffee shop having a coffee with Brendan, and I was walking out, and I knew some guy was looking at me like he'd give me that look where it's sort of like, yeah, I know who you are, and I like you, but I'm trying to be cool. Happens. I've had that look for others. I'm familiar with the look from within and without. And I'm walking out, and he looks at me, and goes, and I look at him, and I'm like, hey, what's up, buddy? He goes, hey, Mark, yeah, big fan. I'm a big fan. And his brain got a little jangled there in the moment. And I was saying, well, thank you. Nice meeting you. I asked him his name. I don't remember now. I'm sorry. He told me his name, and I'm walking out, and he goes, keep up the good luck. I mean, work, keep up the good. Oh, boy, I screwed it up. But keep up the good luck. That was a beautiful mistake. It was one of the greatest things I ever heard. I'm walking out. I'm like, dude, that's a shirt. That's what that is. Keep up the good luck. I'm going to try, man. I've been trying all my life. Finally got a little run of it. But Jesus, folks, keep up the good luck if you can. If you got a run going, keep up the good luck. I clean the garage, man. I do it. I'd like to say I do it yearly, but I hadn't done it in a while, and I had to throw out a lot of stuff, move some stuff out, vacuum. Where does the dust come from? I don't even have the window open here. What is dissolving? What is eroding? What is coming apart that causes so much dust? Is it just from me? Am I emanating dust through the guests? It got to the point here. Well, obviously, I've been in production a lot, and you know, some of you have figured out that sometimes we record interviews and we don't put them up right away. But now it's like we got to get back on it. And I was sitting in my garage. I'm like, I'm a little ashamed of this mess. And it no longer has the kind of cluttered charm that the garage once had. Now it just looks cluttered. There's just stacks of shit everywhere. There's chaos. There's a mess. There's garbage. There's dust. And now I got it. Yeah, I cleaned it up. Can breathe in here. And now it's time to start entertaining people again. More frequently. With pride in my cluttered shithole of a garage. Looks good, though. Looks good. I feel all right about it. Found some interesting stuff. It's weird when you do the cleaning. Because like I was like, I got to do it. I set my mind to it. But then you end up just watching your life slowly pass before your eyes as you go through piles and boxes. You know, looking at my high school diploma. Looking at stuff I wrote 10 years ago. Got a stack of fucking... like Week at a Glances from 2001, 1999. What? I don't even know why I kept those. I think you had to keep them at some point for tax reasons. Just looking at my schedule. That was sort of weird. Underneath an amplifier in here, like a little amp, that's flush with the ground. It's flush with the floor of the garage. I picked it up and there was a fully preserved lizard skin. A lizard had shed his skin under there perfectly. And I don't know how it got under there because it was almost pressed. I don't know. I don't know if it was magic, but I do know that a lizard shed his skin perfectly beneath an amplifier in my garage. And I've tried to do that. I can only aspire to the perfectly shed skin. Right now, let's enjoy my my conversation with Michael Imperioli. Spectacular. Great guy. If you're a fan, you're just going to love hearing his voice. I just loved listening to him for as long as we talked. All right.
Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer, and I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago.
Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF.
Here we go. It's weird. I don't know. I guess I associate you with New York in my head.
Oh, I was there forever till 2 years ago.
Yeah? Are you happy about it? You don't seem thrilled.
No, I'm very happy. I know. It was time for me to change.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Where'd you go?
Santa Barbara.
Right. So, like, why Santa Barbara?
I didn't want to live in a big city anymore.
Yeah.
That was the thing. So, yeah. I mean, New York is the greatest city in the world. But if you don't want to live in a big city, you can't live there.
Right.
Well,
you could have went upstate.
Really, I'm not really crazy about the suburbs in New York.
But further up, like the country, the Hudson Valley.
I wanted something different. We were ready for something different.
Do you live by the beach?
About a mile and a half.
Well, that's not bad. How long of a drive is that?
An hour and a half.
Well, thanks for coming down.
Thanks for having me.
It's weird because, you know, you're one of those guys that I feel like I've seen all my life. I feel familiar with you, but of course I'm not.
No, I feel the same about you. I don't know.
Is that true?
We're not familiar with each other at all. But
no,
we feel like we are. But in reality, we're not, right?
Well, no, I don't know. I guess not. I mean, like, it's hard when you do a role like you did on The Sopranos for as long as you did it.
Yeah.
For people not to have this fucking relationship with you.
Of course.
And then, like, even, you know, when you played Spider and all that stuff, like when I was, you know, younger, I feel like I was younger when I saw you. How old are you?
Almost 49.
All right, so I'm 51. Not that big a difference. Right. But I mean, I imagine that people come up to you all the time and they're like, hey, what's up?
All the time. All the time, yeah.
It's never going to go away.
Probably not.
I fucking miss that show, buddy. Do you?
It was a lot of fun. You know, I miss the camaraderie. We had I knew a lot of those guys even before The Sopranos.
Yeah.
From other jobs.
Yeah.
Some of them from acting school.
Who?
I knew John Ventimiglia, who played the chef, Artie Bucco.
Oh, yeah. He's in your movie.
He was in my movie. I met him when I was 17 in acting school. And we were roommates. And then Sharon Angela, who's also in my movie.
She's great.
The Hungry Ghost. We went to act. I know her since I was 19.
Really? How old were you? What are you, around the same age? It's hard for me to get ages.
Yeah, but we, you know, some of those people in my class started working together in indie film and in theater, and we started a company together.
What school was it?
It was an offshoot of Lee Strasberg Institute. It was a woman named Elaine Aiken who started her own studio.
Uh-huh.
Alec Baldwin was in that class for a while.
Yeah. So it was one of those ones where everyone kind of gravitated around the personality of that woman, whoever that was.
Yeah.
What's her name?
Elaine Aiken. Yeah, she died a number of years ago, but she was a great teacher.
So you were part of that whole sort of New York acting thing, like going through
Yeah, we did that. I took some classes with Stella Adler.
You did?
Yeah, who was Brando's teacher.
Right.
She was still alive. I took some classes with her.
Well, how old were you?
17.
Yeah? And you just had to do that, right?
I just said... You know, I finished high school and, like, what do you... I wound up not going to college.
Yeah.
I kind of bailed.
Yeah.
The night before I was supposed to leave in September and just said I was going to go upstate to Albany. And I was like...
State school to SUNY?
SUNY. And then I was like, you know, I want to be in the city. I want to be an actor. And that's what I did. But, you know, my teacher was really cool because she was like, you know, look, you don't have to go to college, but... If you want to be an actor and you want to be an artist, you have to really educate yourself and you have to learn about art. And
this was Elaine?
About painting and music and
she told
literature.
You that?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I went to museums with her and she turned me on to books and.
One on one?
Sometimes, yeah.
So this woman who was what, in her 70s?
By then, she was probably in her late 60s, maybe early 70s.
Is taking you around, the 17, 18-year-old kid, to the Museum of Modern Art and stuff?
To the Met. She was very generous, you know, that way. And very, you know, another kid who was in that class, a guy named Tom Gilroy, who's now a writer-director. He just had a movie called The Cold Lands that came out, and he directed a movie called Spring Forward a number of years ago.
Uh-huh.
And he was an actor then, and we produced an Arthur Miller play called Incident at Vichy that Tom directed and I produced back in 88. I was like, started producing when I was in my early 20s.
Yeah.
And he started directing, then he started writing, so we started producing his stuff. And a lot of the people who were in my movie were way back in the 80s, we were doing this stuff.
Well, no, it's interesting to me. It's also interesting how, like, when she would take you to museums and stuff, what did you learn? What did you put together at that time? Because where'd you grow up?
I grew up right outside of the city in Mount Vernon, New York.
And what was your family like? What'd your old man do?
He was a bus driver in the Bronx.
Really?
Oh, for 30 years, yeah.
So he's a government job, right?
City job,
City job.
MTA.
Got his pension, retired.
Uh-huh.
That's what he was gunning for the whole way, right?
Semi-retired. He still works, but he gets a pension.
What's he do?
He drives a couple of doctors.
Oh, in the car.
Yeah, it's pretty mellow. They treat him really well.
So. And your mom?
My mom's retired. She was in the school. She worked in a public school.
So what'd she do? Teaching or?
No, secretary.
And so you grew up working class, New York.
Yeah.
Italian.
Yeah.
Very?
Yeah. Italian, you know, third generation.
Right.
But very much that was my neighborhood and friends and stuff.
Catholic.
Yeah.
Food.
Lots of it. Good food. Good stuff.
Well, you won the CHOP thing. You know, I was obsessed with CHOP for a long time.
I won the celebrity competition.
I've had Conant on here, Scott Conant.
Uh-huh.
And I've had...
He wasn't on my episode.
But. I've had, you know, what's her name? Alex Guarnicelli.
She was one of my judges.
She's tough, man.
She was good to me, though.
Yeah.
She was really good to me.
Who were you up against?
I was up... The finalist was Brandi Chastain, who was the... the Olympic women's soccer team.
Yeah.
She was the chick who took off her shirt and was wearing a sports bra, that famous picture. She was the final. It was me and her in the
final.
Was
she good?
She was pretty good, yeah.
Where'd you learn how to cook?
You know, I worked in restaurants for many, many years in all aspects of the business. And I learned a little bit there, but then I really learned from doing it because my wife doesn't cook. So when we started having kids, we used to get takeout in New York from every restaurant because we were always on the go. And I started hating I just got sick of everything.
Stack of menus.
Yeah, I just wanted home food. Yeah. So I started learning stuff that I liked and, you know, still just keep, after, you know, 18 years of doing it, you start.
You got a knack for
getting
it.
Getting good, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, you got to have a feel for it.
I like to eat. So you like to eat.
But some people can't fucking do it. They can't cook. They just can't get it.
Yeah, it takes a little. I guess you have to have a little knack.
You got to, like, I think the key is, like, you have to be able to conceptualize what you're cooking.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
You got to see the end.
You got to see the end, and you get inspired by an ingredient.
Yeah.
You go, like, where I live, they have a great farmer's market on the weekend. You go and you see what's in season, what looks good, and then you're like, oh, I can make this.
Yeah.
With this and
you love it, right?
Oh, it's nice. Yeah.
All right. So back to the museum. So you're hanging around with this acting teacher. What's her name again? Elaine
Aiken. Yeah.
Famous.
I think John Ventimiglia and I went with her when they had a. I remember in the late '80s they had the Hermitage in Russia. They sent this big collection over of a lot of the big impressionists like Van Gogh and Picasso and stuff, but stuff that had never been seen in the West. You know, for a long time. I don't think it was. Probably right before the wall came down.
Yeah.
But somehow they had this exchange, so we went to see these paintings, and it really made a big... It was the first time I kind of understood what an artist did, you know?
Like,
what is he doing? He's not just painting what he sees. He's painting, he's interpreting what he sees through his emotion. That day, I really kind of clicked.
Sunk in. Right. Yeah. So exactly what she wanted you to know about art.
Yeah, there was a painting by Van Gogh called Rain.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it since, but it was very abstract. And it was, you know, it was his thing of the rain. And then it kind of clicked. For me, at least at that point.
It's a good moment, right?
It was a big moment, yeah. But, you know, I remember that. And it really instilled, you know, a conceptual notion of what an artist does or can do. And she gave me that. That's very big that for a teacher to instill in a student. You know?
Well, it's interesting that she knew innately, you know, as somebody who's teaching creative people how to act, that you need to know about these other things.
Yes.
You know, you need to, you know, if you're not going to go to college, you need to broaden your your thing.
Right. She never said you need to get good headshots. She was totally unconcerned with the whatever methods of getting work. She never spoke about agents. She never spoke about auditions or anything like that. She was all about the craft, and that was it.
And what, do you still use her principles or ideas?
Yeah, all the time. I do because it's, the thing I took most from her is a way of creating privacy, you know, on the set.
Right.
Really.
Uh-huh.
So you can be free to express yourself without inhibitions.
Well, and now that was an idea she showed you guys.
Well, through technique, they use sense memory. Uh-huh. They, you know, there was this one exercise called private moment, which basically you create, say, you know, Mark, you're going to create how you feel in this because you like being in the studio. You get inspired in the studio. You create here.
Yeah.
So you imagine, okay, here's the walls, here's the shelves, here's the books. And then you infuse that with whatever scene you're doing.
Okay.
And hope, you know, and I can use that because sometimes, you know, you're shooting on the street and there's people watching and there's helicopters and there's noise and there's people yelling and let's go. You need to find a way to center yourself, to concentrate, to focus in these things. And that's one way that really works for me. And that's something that she taught us. She really, that was a big exercise for her.
Yeah. And I noticed, you know, in your movie, which I watched yesterday, which it's been a few years, right?
We shot that in 2008.
And where is it at now? You can just get it. It's available on Netflix.
Well, it was on Netflix for a long time. I don't know if it's still there. It was there for a long time. It's called The Hungry Ghost. So I don't know if the website, if you can order it there. Virgil Films is the distributor. You could probably order it from them.
Were you happy with that movie?
Oh, yeah.
How long did it take you to make that?
25 days.
Yeah. And you wrote the whole thing.
Yeah.
And directed the whole thing. You have a little bit of a cameo in there.
No.
Right? You're not in it at all?
No.
Oh, I thought you were the cop. You're not the cop?
That's my brother.
I look at him, I was like, geez, he put on weight. What
my younger brother, yeah.
He's the
my
cop?
My father was the guy who picks Steve up in the car service in the beginning.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
No, I thought it was a very engaging movie. It was a little disturbing.
Yeah.
And it took on all the big questions. But I noticed that everyone was acting their balls off.
Yeah.
In the sense that, like, these were, you know, because I didn't know a lot of those people. I know the kid. I saw him in the movie with
Ryan Gosling.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think this was his first movie.
Like, how old was he?
He was 18. I didn't know him. That was pretty much the only part that we auditioned people. Pretty much everyone else in that movie, that the parts were written for them. My wife and I had a theater that we built in New York. We produced new plays for a number of years.
I remember that. What was it called?
Studio Dante.
Yeah.
And about 18 or 19 of those actors were either in productions or in the class. We had classes there. We taught acting.
You taught?
Yeah. I taught Sharon, Angela, Vince Curatola, who played Johnny Sack, and Nick Sandow, mm-hmm. who is now on Orange is the New Black. He's the other lead in the movie.
Yeah.
Four of us taught at the school, at the theater. But mostly we produce new plays.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Shripa I know from comedy. He used to book a room at the Trop.
Did you work the room then?
No. No, I never worked there. No. But I remember his name and I remember him being around.
But did you stand up in Vegas?
Not much.
I wanted to bring my son tonight because he's a stand-up comedian.
Is he?
Yeah, he just turned 17 Saturday.
Uh-huh.
And the last year he's been performing on in clubs.
Oh yeah, and I don't know classes. If I've met him.
No, you've never met him, but he's in junior in high school, so he had a lot of projects, but he couldn't make it down. But he kind of was the one who said you have to do this this show because he has a book that you wrote that I got him, and he's
my book.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
he's a very big fan of yours.
That's very nice. That's what landed you.
He kind of sealed the deal. You know, he's like, because he's a big admirer of yours. So.
Well, that's very sweet. What's his name?
Vadim.
Vadim.
Yeah.
Where'd you get
that's
that?
A Russian. My wife is Russian.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that's very that's exciting, man. Well, I wish him the best of luck. How's he doing? Is he funny?
He's funny, man. He writes his own stuff. He's good. He performed once in L.A. at the John Lovitz Club in Universal City Hall.
Oh, my God. That's so horrendous.
It was a good experience for him because he was with, you know.
Real comics?
Yeah. It was like a
It's
Tuesday
just a weird
night.
Location.
Yeah, it's not a destination. It's people who are going on their way. But the staff there is great. They're really good people. Oh, and he's done a bunch of clubs in Santa Barbara. He opened for Lee Camp. Do you know him? He opened for Yakov Smirnoff.
Yakov. I've had Yakov in here.
Yeah, a team opened for him once in Santa Barbara. And a couple of the pretty good comics.
So what's he got, like 20 minutes?
15.
That's great, man. How do you feel about your kid going into the arts?
That's scary watching him. I mean, 10 o'clock on a Saturday, there's a room full of drunk people. Your son, you know, he looks really young. He's 17, but he looks even younger.
So
he gets on stage and it's pretty frightening, you know.
Are you concerned for the struggle of entering show business?
I think today everything's a struggle. I mean, what isn't a struggle? I mean, you know, he's going to have to support himself doing other things anyway. So it's not unlike any other job, it seems. But
that's a good way to look at it.
People are going to do what they're, you know, destined to do and what they would hopefully.
If they feel the courage, and the support.
Yeah, he has a really good teacher in Santa Barbara named Louise Palanker.
A stand-up teacher?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, she runs a teen. That's how he got into it. She runs a teen comedy class in Santa Barbara.
Uh-huh.
And he was kind of doing class clown stuff and getting in class clown trouble in school.
Right.
And I found this class. I said, you're going to go.
You suggested it?
He said, no, I don't want to do this. And the first time he went, he goes, that's the greatest thing I've ever done. And now he's hooked. Yeah. I suggested it to challenge
really?
His energy. Yeah.
That's great.
And
now
Louise,
it's stuck.
Louise is a great, she's been a great
and
mentor.
And now you got a comic in the family.
Now I got a comic in the family.
And what are the other kids? How old are they? Is he the oldest?
He's the middle. I have a daughter who's 24, who's into photography. She's in school in New York at SUNY Purchase.
Shooting
and art management now.
Really?
She's getting into studying that. And then I have a 13-year-old boy who's into guitar.
Yeah? All artists. All in the arts.
All in the arts, yeah.
You play guitar, right?
I do, yeah.
You good?
yeah, that's very...
What? You know what I'm saying.
I mean, I play in a band. I mean,
I read about that. I couldn't find a record though. The soundtrack was a great soundtrack.
The opening instrumental is my band, is Zopa, but a lot of the singer songwriter stuff, that was Elijah Amatun, who plays in my band. He plays bass, but he writes his own music, and he scored a lot of that original.
It sounded great.
Yeah, he did a lot of that for the.
Yeah, some of it sounded kind of Stonesy.
Yeah, he's really good.
Yeah.
And then the band stuff, like the opening instrumental, is our band. But he did his own stuff for the score.
Was that the original dream, or was it the side dream? Rock and roll, playing music.
Acting kind of was the first thing I went into. But yeah. I started playing in bands pretty much at the same time.
Yeah.
And I played guitar in one band, and then I started singing with another band. Right when I started working as an actor, and I couldn't do both at the same time
right.
at that point in my life. So, I was, the one band I was in, I was singing. It was a drummer and a guitar player. And they went on, after I left, they got this woman, Brenda Sauter, who was in the Feelies.
Oh, you know that band? Yeah.
And they formed a band called Wild Carnation out of that. And some of the music that we wrote, they went on and did other versions of without my lyrics.
Uh-huh. They do all right?
Yeah, really good. But so I that was something, in the 80s in New York, a lot of people were doing a lot of different things. It wasn't uncommon for artists to, Basquiat had a band that he played in, a band with Vincent Gallo.
Vincent Gallo
was a painter when he started, before he was an actor.
Are you friends with him?
I met him once on the street. We ran into each other and had about a 2-hour conversation.
Yeah.
On the Bleecker Street. That was the only time we ever met. Yeah.
I think he lives. I don't wonder if he lives here.
He's an interesting guy.
Yeah, I'm curious talented. About that guy. Yeah, I haven't seen him in a while. I don't know what he's up to.
He's very talented.
Yeah, he's a little scary to me.
Some people think that, I guess.
Yeah, he's just one of those guys where he strikes me as a guy. It's like, I don't know if he's fucking with me or not.
No, we had a very... It was one of those times you just... All of a sudden, you stop what you're doing and have this 2-hour conversation with someone you never met. It was very... Yeah, it was really interesting.
Well, New York in the 80s, I was there in 89. That's when I got there. And it was sort of like there was still that feeling of vitality to Lower East Side art scene and what was left of performance art was sort of still around. It was right before it all kind of went away and became something else. It seemed like a very exciting place to live.
It was very exciting.
When were you there? Like what?
83.
Oh, so that was like the middle of it.
Fantastic.
And you were like, what, 17?
17, yeah. Oh, it was like Oz.
Yeah, yeah.
Not the TV show, the movie.
Everything was still like happening.
It was very exciting.
Parties and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And did you know Basquiat?
No, I didn't know. I knew some of the people from that scene a couple of years later, like Kenny Scharf.
Uh-huh.
Debbie Mazar was part of that scene, and Joey Arias and those people.
Yeah.
It was exciting.
God damn, man. Well, I know, like, watching your movie, like, if you wrote that, if that came out of you, you had a fight with something.
Yeah.
I mean, there was...
A lot of people had, a lot of people in my circle. That movie came out of a place of, spiritual searching and...
Addiction.
Seeing a lot of addiction around me. Yeah, a lot of, and what started out as kind of part of the scene and kind of, casual and part of the lifestyle. And then over time, you see it start to just destroy people.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah, people get strung out, can't stop. Lose the
life. And they rely on it. And, it goes from being, something that's part of your youth to something that's killing you.
Yeah, you saw a lot of that?
Yeah.
Well, that movie, like, they're struggling with, spiritual elements, and to be... The lead character was an interesting character. It reminded me a little of the movie... Like, it's a hard role to play. The guy that is, sort of demonically possessed with the truth and it's existentially sort of...
Or what he thinks is the truth.
Right.
Yeah.
But he's it's all a negation.
Yes. That's what it became. It started out, he probably started out with very good intentions and had a lot of artistic sensibilities and ambitions, but never quite fulfilled them. And, had was a seeker, a spiritual seeker, maybe read. And then that stuff started to turn on itself when he couldn't, basically, he couldn't let go of his ego. He wanted it on his own terms, you know. He kind of was almost too smart for his own good.
Right.
And he understood things in a very literal, intellectual way, but he was never able to really integrate those things into true compassionate action, you know. He takes this guy, he takes this homeless guy in, but he starts out with very different intent. He kind of does it as this kind of Kerouacian kind of beat on the road where I'm hanging with this guy, we're drinking in the park, and then he kind of feels responsible. He gets a motel room, he puts this guy up, and this guy kind of, you know, starts to treat him like shit, you know.
And shits all over himself.
And he has to clean it up. And
you don't see it.
I spared the viewers all that stuff.
But I thought that was an interesting moment, because what's that guy going to do? And the fact that he cleaned him up, was sort of an interesting moment.
Right.
That he made that choice.
Right.
Could have split.
Yeah. It kind of was based on a real life experience, actually. When my wife and I owned a bar for a while.
Yeah.
I've never actually told anybody this, that it was based on this. What happened was, is a guy who was drinking in the bar got really drunk, passed out.
Yeah.
So we kind of figure, all right, let him sleep it off. Now it's 4 o'clock in the morning, we're cleaning up, the guy's still passed out. So we wake the guy up. Turns out he's on leave or AWOL or something from the military.
Yeah.
And doesn't know where he's staying. This is with bars in Chelsea. Doesn't know where he's staying in New York. His ID says Arizona. I call his father in Arizona. His father doesn't know anything, doesn't know where he's staying, doesn't know if he's with the army or not. And he guy was an asshole.
Yeah.
The guy was just degrading women, cursing at other customers, nasty to me, you know, fuck you. And I'm sorry.
You can cuss here.
You can. Okay. Yeah. But now he passes out. Now he wakes up. I don't know what to do with him. So I put him in a cab. I get in a cab with him.
Is he still shit-faced?
Shit-faced. Yeah. Out of his mind. Doesn't know where he is.
Yeah.
We go to this hotel on the west side that I know is like a flop house and cheap place. Because, I didn't have a lot of money on me then or whatever. Yeah. I get him a room. It was like $50. Bring him, now I gotta get him up the stairs, and he starts cursing at people, and I start yelling at him, pretending I'm like his sergeant.
Yeah.
I'm like, you're a soldier, your job is to protect the people, not to abuse the people. And he's like, oh, yeah, okay, yes, you're right. And put him in bed.
That was, you took that role?
$5 on his,
the
nightstand, and then closed the door, and then just left.
Right.
And you know, a lot of people say, well, why are you going to do that? You know, the guy's an asshole. You should just... But if I left him on the street, he probably would... Someone would have kicked his head in or something because he was...
Rolled him, whatever.
Yeah, or he would have started mouthing off to the wrong person.
Right.
But, so when I was writing the script, I kind of thought of that thing, and it's like, when you take that step to kind of help somebody, just because you feel a little bit... He was young. He was probably 21, 22.
Right.
He was got drunk in my place. Now I feel kind of responsible.
Right.
I didn't know what else to do. I'm not going to take him to my house. You know what I mean? Because, I had kids and you got, who knows what he's going to do.
Right. But you felt like you wanted to take care of him.
I didn't have the heart to leave the guy on the street.
Right.
Which was the only other option. He didn't know where to go. He had a hotel key with no name of the hotel on it. You know what I mean? It was just like...
So maybe he'll figure it out the next day. That's what your thought was.
He's going to figure something out the next day when he's sober. At least he'll know where the hell he is.
But what were you saying about when you start to get involved, when you do something compassionate, there's a moment where you...
Well, where you're opening yourself to... It's not necessarily going to go the way... You're not going to get reward. I mean, the guy, like, abused me the whole time, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Cursed at me. Oh, attacked me at one point.
Yeah.
When we got out of the cab... Started, went at me, and that's I just remembered that I left that part out of the story. Literally attacked me and I had to kind of calm him down again. But you take that step, and it doesn't just because you're acting out of you're trying to be a nice guy doesn't mean that it's going to go the way you want, and they're going to understand that you're being nice, or appreciate it.
Right, right.
That's where that scene came out of.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it didn't. It's not the same scene.
No, but
it was inspired by.
But the idea of selflessness. Let's say,
because it was. I think I'm looking back on myself saying it was kind of a bullshit altruistic act in my mind. I think I was kind of I don't know. I mean, maybe in some respects.
Well, no, you took care of the guy.
Yeah, I felt kind of responsible.
Right. Well, I mean, so
but I probably shouldn't have served him all those. I didn't serve him. Someone else did. But we probably should have been a little more careful on how much the guy was drinking when we were, you know.
So it wasn't completely altruistic. You wanted to clear your conscience.
He was. Yes.
Right.
Probably.
Yeah. Why not? Well, that's still good.
I
never heard back from the guy.
Never heard back. Well, I didn't leave him my information, but I don't even think he probably remembered where he was. I don't know how he got there. I think he got there with people, but at some point he was alone. He didn't remember who he was with. I mean, imagine waking up in this hotel. Then I thought, God, imagine he's going to wake up in that hotel room hungover.
Yeah.
He's not going to know where the hell he is.
Yeah.
Even when he walks out, he's not going to know where he is, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's going to be exciting.
He had no money on him.
Exciting day for him.
Exciting day trying to figure out how to get back.
But with all that, did you find that with that script, because, you know, it's nicely shot, it's beautifully put together, it's a big undertaking, that movie. Mm. It's funny because I noticed you were shooting at Gimme Gimme Records. And they have one.
I just saw it.
It's
here.
Him.
It's the same guy.
He moved here.
He was a friend of the producer.
And yeah,
he
Dan.
He let us have.
I've shot there in my TV show.
I drove by and I was like, God, that's the place.
I texted him last night. I said, I'm looking at your old store.
Yeah.
Yeah, same guy.
And we got posters from Robert Pollard gave us some posters.
Guided by Voices.
And Lou Reed gave us a poster to use for the movie.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, I had to reach out for my TV show. I got to reach out to everybody. You can't fucking everything. You can't put anything up.
Did you
know Lou Reed?
Yeah, he came to this when we screened it in New York. He came to see it, which was a big deal for me. I get, you know, Lou is my hero, basically.
Yeah.
Out of anybody.
God, I fucking love him.
And
I just bought a second copy of The Blue Mask yesterday.
Well, that's a good one. So he performed in 2000. He did the Ecstasy album, and he did a tour, and he played at the Knitting Factory in Tribeca. So yeah. I called my manager. I said, listen, could you get, because the show was on the air. So at that, then I was able to like get tickets sometime. I said, can you get tickets for Lou Reed? She said, okay, because it was sold out. She got me tickets. The show was over. And my wife and I was about to leave, and someone came and said, Lou wants to meet you. And I was like, Lou wants
just out of nowhere?
Well, I guess they got the tickets through the publicist, and he knew.
But you never met him before.
I met him twice, but he didn't know who I was. You know, I met him on the street. He would walk. I lived in the village. He lived in the village. You'd see Lou Reed walking around the village from time to time, and a couple of times I said stuff, but he didn't know who I was.
Because I went and got a record signed by him in college at a record store. I tell the story before.
He was just shopping there.
No, he was there to sign the record, and I waited online to get.
Oh, that's amazing. What record was it?
I got him to sign Transformer, but he was on the new Sensations junket.
But so he signed Transformer.
I got Transformer. But I got all the Velvet stuff. I got all kinds of. I love that guy. All right, so
we went backstage, and he was like, he just was really nice, and we stayed in touch. You know, I have a.
He was nice. What did he say?
Oh yeah. He just. Was very complimentary about the show and my acting, and he was really happy that I came. And I just said, "Man, I said your music has always been with me, you know, in my adult life, and has got me through a lot of things." And he gave me a big hug. It was a very big moment for me. And on my wall, my office, I have the last email that I got from him 2 months before he passed away. And he, you know, to me, he was the great American poet of the 20th century.
I mean, No doubt. Really,
I mean, him and Ginsberg. I mean, they, when you look at the scope of what he's done over all this time, I mean, he was still so, throughout his, you know, to the end of his life, so creative and still doing new music and just being brilliant.
And so New York.
So New York. It's not the same without him.
It can't be.
No,
did you go to the funeral or anything?
No, I didn't go. I was here and on the West Coast. I wasn't able to.
Did you know he was sick?
Yeah, everyone pretty much knew. I didn't, and then I found out that he had the transplant.
Yeah, is that what happened? Didn't take? Is that what happened?
A mutual friend said, yeah, he got the transplant. It wasn't so. You know, I got back and got back in touch with him, and then. You know, that was, yeah. But when the night we had the screening of The Hungry Ghost was at the Rubin Museum in New York, which was a Buddhist museum, Tibetan Buddhist art. And he came, and that was like, that was, to me, that was That's fantastic.
But those were, that was a generation, like we're third generation away from that.
But they were around, man. In, well, I worked at a place called Cafe Bruxelles on Greenwich Avenue in New York.
Yeah.
Across the street from that place, for this is 1988, there was a place called the Rare Book Room. So yeah. One day I walk into the place, and Gregory Corso's in there.
Sure, yeah.
With the owner. Greg Corso's behind the counter. I don't know if he's working there or what. And then Herbert Hunke walks in.
Really?
And Peter Orlovsky.
Come on.
Those guys were all still around in the 80s. And then
Hunke must
have
been just a little tiny ex-junkie, huh?
Hunke, right when he died, I was living on the same floor as the Chelsea Hotel as him. He lived on the 8th floor.
You lived in the Chelsea Hotel?
For about a year, and he was on the floor that. And the last time I saw him, I helped him in the cab, and he said, "Someday I'm going to do the same for you." And then he died a couple of months later.
Did you meet Ginsberg, or was he gone?
I met him on the street outside St. Mark's Church, outside a poetry reading, got him to sign Kaddish.
Uh-huh.
How do you pronounce that?
Kaddish.
Kaddish. Yeah.
It's a hell of a...
All those guys were around.
Great.
For years.
Yeah, you know? I know.
Burroughs
was in New York for a year.
I never met Burroughs.
Yeah, I mean, I think he lived down on, you know, over by CBGB somewhere for a while.
He lived on the Bowery, the bunker. And John Giorno lives in that loft now.
He's still?
I think the same place, yeah. I think he inherited it or took it over from Burroughs.
What? Who turned you on to those guys? At what point?
Was the guy that I mentioned, Tom Gilroy, who's now a filmmaker.
Yeah.
He turned me on the road.
When you were like 18, 17?
Yeah, I had never even heard of those guys. And then I started reading all the Beat. I loved
it. That was your thing.
I loved
it. Got you in, right? Gets you in.
Yeah.
Right, because it gets you into New York. It gets you, like, you know, through that portal, you get to Warhol, you get to Lou, you get to everybody in a way.
Yes.
Because, if you're compelled creatively along those lines,
right.
All of it, like, you know, even the art. I mean, you know, people resist it. They'll fight back against it. But that was it. You know, that Beat New York is where it was.
Well,
at.
The Beats gave birth to the hippie movement.
I'm not sure that they're happy about it. But yeah.
Well, I mean, look at the influence it had on, you know, politically and culturally and artistically.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, like, the pushback against, like, you know, the whatever Eisenhower was doing or whatever. But, like, but between Neil Cassady and William Burroughs, you know, you get a lot of things. You know, I mean, you don't really get like, they all seem to have their role, because Burroughs is the portal to all that heroin stuff. I mean, to, like, you know, the glorification of it, any of it.
And then there's the Paul Bowles.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Then and Geisen, Brian Geisen, doing the Dream Machine and
pretty wild stuff. They just found this long lost letter. Have you heard about this?
Uh-uh.
The Joan Anderson letter, which it's called the Joan Anderson letter. So Neil Cassady wrote Kerouac a
Joan's
letter.
You mean Kerouac's wife, is it?
Joan Anderson was a girl that Neil was dating at the time. But he wrote Kerouac a letter. This is before On the Road.
Yeah.
18-page letter.
Yeah.
Kerouac reads this letter, and it basically, you know, he wrote The Town and the City, which was a very more straightforward,
Thomas Wolfe book, yeah.
Right, classically in style. He read this letter. This letter... basically changed the way, and Kerouac had this epiphany, I'm going to write like this guy, this spontaneous bop prose,
right?
Which is how Neil wrote letters.
Right.
Neil was 22, but he was kind of on a reform school.
Yeah,
kid,
yeah.
But had this incredible literary sense.
So Joan had this letter.
And they call it Joan Anderson letter because he mentions this story of Joan Anderson, a girlfriend, I think, who wound up in a mental hospital or something like that. Anyway, Kerouac gives it to Ginsberg, and it circulates among the Beats, and then it's lost. It's been lost since the 50s.
Really?
It just resurfaced in the archives of an old, defunct publishing house called the Golden Goose Press. But this one letter really...
was the key.
To changing kind of American literature.
Sure.
It's really quite... they thought it fell into, you know, the Pacific Ocean up near San Francisco, off Sausalito. That was the last time it was seen.
Really?
Hasn't been seen in 50 years.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's the letter where he's like, all right, well, Neil's not going to do it.
Yeah.
I guess it's on me.
It's pretty wild. Right?
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
That's fascinating that you're into this shit, because I mean, I love it. I love it.
Yeah, no, it was a big moment in literature, you know.
It's but for you, I mean, you know, I think that it sort of informs to me, you know, certainly that movie, you know, the idea of searching for either, you know, spiritual truth or poetic truth or artistic truth. I mean, it seemed like, you know, that's, you're compelled by that. And that, you know, whatever gift the Beat Generation gave you, whatever the gift Elaine gave you in understanding that you have that within you, it's sort of what drives you.
Yeah.
So in terms of struggling with these things, was drugs ever a problem for you?
No, that wasn't a problem for me, but it was a problem for a lot of people around me.
So you saw the horror of it. But what about the spiritual search? Where'd you land on that?
I was brought up Catholic. I got exposed to the Buddhism through Jack Kerouac, you know, through reading his stuff in my early teens, but I kind of liked the ideas of it, but I wasn't really ready for it, you know. So I started to, around this time when I wrote this movie, I was really reading a lot of different kind of spiritual writers, like Gurdjieff and Uspensky and Castaneda and all that stuff.
You can follow
it? Well, I liked it a lot, but it didn't really, nothing really kind of took hold of me till I started reading Tibetan Buddhism and started going to teachings and started seeing, you know, actual, real, authentic Tibetan Buddhist teachers.
You started going to teachings?
Yeah.
What does one do there? You just sit there?
Listen to a teacher.
To the guy?
Yeah, I mean, my teacher is a guy named Garchen Rinpoche, who's a Tibetan Buddhist Lama, who he's in his late 70s now. He spent 20 years in prison in Tibet after the Chinese, you know, occupied Tibet in 1959. And then when he got out of prison, made his way to the West through India. You know, like I said, I would read a lot of these books before I got into Buddhism, and they would make sense and they'd inspire me, but nothing really, after the book was done,
didn't stick.
But through Buddhism, I found a practice that you can, you know, start to work on a daily basis or some semi-daily basis.
Yeah.
And then I felt things sticking more.
Like a meditation practice?
Yeah, meditation, yeah, definitely.
What else?
Well, reading, you know, texts. But the most important thing is to find, in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, the Lama, the guru, the teacher is of paramount importance, really, finding the right teacher.
All right, so you do meditation, and the Lama is of utmost importance. What does that mean?
Well, because he's your link to the teachings of the Buddha, which is, you know,
right.
And
that goes back. His Lama goes back to his Lama. And then,
well, why I like the Tibetan tradition is that because of its geographic location, its isolation.
Mm.
You know, it was isolated for so many centuries that a lot of the teachings kind of, you know, stayed very...
Yeah.
They stayed in very specific lineages, oral lineages from one teacher to the next. So, you know, now in the 21st century, you know, there's still these teachers alive who, like Garchen Rinpoche, who, you know, became a monk in Tibet, you know, before it was occupied by the Chinese.
So now, are you in touch with your guy?
Yeah, I saw him last week. In Arizona. You know, he has a center in Arizona, in the desert, in the mountains.
How often do you have to check in?
Well, I whenever I can. He has a center in L.A., in Arcadia, that he teaches there once in a while, and all over the world, actually, in Asia and Europe and Russia.
And when you say teachings, when you go, so you read and you teach, what...
He teaches, I mean, on different things, you know. I mean, he'll teach on different aspects of Buddha. I mean, the teachings of the Buddha are very vast. You know, the Buddha taught for 50 years. You know?
Really?
There's a lot of
there,
teachings.
Huh?
A lot, yeah.
How does it help you on a day-to-day basis, outside of being calmer or whatever? Like, how does it help you problem solve or move through things?
Well, I mean... This is more for other people to say about me who are with me all the time to confirm that it's actually true. In my mind, I'd like to think there's certain things. What did, you know, I mean, for me, it's a lot, you know, something happens and you react to it, right? That's how, you know.
Sure.
So practice can give you a moment or a gap to think or pause before you react, right? So mm-hmm. somebody cuts you off, your instinct is to drive by, give the guy the finger, sure. cut him off,
right.
do something like that. You know, hot you get head. That impulse.
Sure.
Sometimes. This is just an example, right?
You an angry guy?
No, not necessarily. I'm just right. giving you, I'm
no,
not,
I get
this
it.
Is
I get
not
it.
Even my own example. Okay. It's a general example.
Okay.
But then you can have a moment where you get the presence of mind that it's like, okay, is this what I want to do? Is this going to be productive? What, you know, because one of the big tenets and foundations of, you know, Buddhism is karma, right? The yeah. law of cause and effect. Yeah. Every action has a reaction and yeah. those things.
Uh-huh.
So your action, if you do a very aggressive act, very often the reaction is going to be uh-huh. of aggression.
Sure. Yeah, I get it.
But, you know, and I knew these things, but before they only went so far and stayed intellectual, right? When you actually start to, if you are lucky enough to be around teachers and be around really good, authentic teachers.
Uh-huh.
And develop a practice, then maybe you can be able to. I mean, I'm a student, man. I'm, you know, kindergarten. You
yeah.
know what I mean?
Yeah.
But
it's working for you.
I find a lot of, it's a very rich and a lot of wisdom there for me.
Yeah. How many years you been in it?
Funny enough, when this we shot this 2008, this film, then as soon as it was done editing.
Yeah.
When the film was edited, when, kind of found the teacher, yeah.
So 2009-ish?
Yeah, around.
So pretty.
6 years.
Pretty recent.
6 years, yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's good, man. And it doesn't require anything of you financially or promoting-wise or, you know, it's not like a religion. It's more of a...
Well, I mean, it doesn't require you to do anything, no.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you want to. Unless
right.
you feel, you know...
Well, yeah, you support what are you going
to
support.
If you
yeah.
feel... inspired to do that, but it's not. No, they don't recruit people. They don't do any proselytizing. They don't go door to door. We don't yeah. do any of those things.
Yeah. So is that why you screened the movie at the Tibetan Buddhist Center?
Yeah.
Because it must have been new. You must
by
been...
then we want. You know, we. Yeah, I forget exactly how that came about, but we thought it would be a cool, auspicious
it's,
place.
It's interesting though, because like there is something poetic about Buddhism, and with your sort of. You know, your respect for Lou and for poets and for stuff like that. For
Lou and I did a bunch of fundraisers for Buddha. Lou was a student of Mingyur Rinpoche, who was another Tibetan Buddhist Lama.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
For a long time?
I don't know. I mean, you know, when you become a Buddhist, you take refuge. That's what it's called when you actually officially, whatever, become, yeah. you take refuge. It's called taking refuge. I don't know if he did, but I know he studied with Mingyur Rinpoche for a while, yeah.
What the?
He was involved in the Buddhist community in New York, yeah.
And you spent a lot of time with Lou?
I didn't spend a lot of time, but the time I spent with him was very precious to me.
Yeah.
I can't say I spent tons, but I mean...
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know...
He's a nice guy memorable. To you.
He was very generous and kind, yeah.
That's sweet.
Yeah.
So the first, like, when you started getting roles... You were like, what, 18, 19? When did
no.
you play Spider? When did that happen?
When I was 23.
Were you friends with the kid who played the Leotis brother? He's a New York
Kevin
actor.
Kevin Corrigan.
Yeah, Kevin Corrigan.
Yeah. Well,
were you in the same crew?
I know him now. I mean, we met a little bit after Goodfellas. But I knew his brother. His brother and I worked in a wedding hall in the Bronx as waiters.
Really?
His brother Kenny, yeah. Oddly enough. But Kevin's a great actor. I love Kevin.
Yeah.
I think he's tremendous.
I just didn't know how many of y'all knew each other.
I know him way back before, you know, probably right after Goodfellas.
You worked in a wedding hall?
Yeah.
Just
Italian weddings.
When you're high school?
17, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of kids in my neighborhood did.
So, all right, so you get this job with Scorsese. What was that? Must
oh,
have been
yeah.
amazing. What, so you go yeah. in on a general casting?
I had just gotten an agent to start. I guess I was 22.
Yeah.
89, 23. And so I went to meet the casting director, Julia Taylor, Ellen Lewis, and they said, oh, they liked what I did. And they next thing I know is auditioning for him. And
were you just blown? Was your mind blown?
Oh, what? Yeah. I mean, what, Italian kid, actor in New York, and for him, yeah.
For Scorsese?
And then I didn't know. And then they said De Niro's going to be in. Then De Niro's going to be in the scene with you. I was just like, you know, it's crazy. It's like all of a sudden you're from, you know, college, and then now you're playing on the Yankees or something. It's, you know, it's crazy.
Was he a big influence on you, De Niro?
Yeah, sure.
How could he not
How
be?
How could
right?
he not at that point in time? Yeah, yeah. In the 70s and early 80s.
Yeah. So, all right, so they cast you?
Yeah.
And then, like, you got to do that thing.
I had to do that scene, which was all pretty much all the dialogue was improvised. It was different every time. And except for the line where he tells the guy to go fuck himself. But all that other stuff was all improvised.
So Scorsese said, get to go fuck yourself. Get
basically
there somehow.
Said, all he said was, so the first scene, I don't say that, go fuck yourself in the second scene. The first scene, right. he just said, just bring
Joe Pesci.
Jimmy a drink. Yeah, yeah. Jimmy was De Niro. Jimmy,
yeah, yeah.
But what the thing that he did, that Scorsese did that was so cool was he said to me, when I got there, he was like, treat the actors as the character on and off set. And that made it kind of easy for me because I was so nervous, you know?
Yeah.
So I didn't have to relate. So what I did was I told the prop guy, I said, let me take care of the table, which they did. And I set up the bar.
Yeah.
And then I went up to, when De Niro came sat down, I went, what do you want to drink, Jimmy?
Yeah.
And he was like, shot of scotch and a glass of water.
Yeah.
At first he was kind of, and then, so I brought him the, and this was not, the camera wasn't.
Right. Yeah.
So that kind of helped, you know, just to kind of be that.
He played along with you after
a beat? Yeah, he loved it. Because he doesn't want to, the last thing he wants is some young actor start to talk about Mean Streets or something to him. He just wants to do his thing.
Yeah, right.
He doesn't want, how did you start in the business, Bobby? You know, he doesn't want to hear that.
So you're like a year into acting. So what?
No, by then I was about 5, 6 years.
Oh, okay.
I'd studied. I'd gone on auditions and auditions for years and never got shit for years. I did a play right before that.
So where do you, how'd you put together, because it's a very significant. There are two scenes that are great, but you know, you put together a character.
Yeah, well, we started rehearsing. See, the genius of Scorsese, we shot 2 days. One scene, one day. I mean, you have almost a whole day to do the whole scene. The first hours in the morning are spent just rehearsing.
Yeah.
Improvising, right? So I started off and I was a little bit of a wise ass, and Scorsese said, you know, maybe it's good if this guy is like a little slow.
Right.
Like he's not just... So I was like, okay. So I started stuttering.
Yeah.
Which made, you know, gave Joe Pesci a lot to work with.
Right.
And that's how we just did it different every time.
It just like stuttering stuck.
Yeah, I guess, you know, slow. I was like, well, slow. Am I going to be like, duh?
What
do you want? Right. So I don't know. It was just an instinct.
And did he liked it. Scorsese was like, that's it?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, yeah, he just, you know, a good director, somebody like that, he just makes an atmosphere. Like what I was talking about before, about you want to create, you want a sense of privacy so you don't feel inhibited.
Right.
The worst thing you could have is some asshole yells at you.
Yeah.
Embarrasses you, makes you feel like scared to create. And then you close up and you just do.
Has that happened to you?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. There's a lot. More before.
You became known.
Anybody knew. When you have a little bit of juice in the business, people tend to treat you with a little more respect, but when you're young, they take liberties, you know.
Yeah. Well, I know, you know, you've done a ton of movies, but like, you know, it's like but The Sopranos, like, I can't imagine, like, did you have any idea it was gonna go for as long?
No, not at the beginning. No.
Did you know James before?
No, I knew almost everybody else but not him. I didn't even know his work.
No It wasn't a lot. There wasn't a ton of it.
He'd done a lot of plays.
Yeah.
Broadway.
Yeah. Did you become friends with him?
Oh, yeah. Right off the bat.
Oh, yeah?
One of our first scenes, I was driving him, and I think it's the pilot. It's in the pilot. And we chase some guy. He's running down the sidewalk, and we chase him with the car and stuff like that. And now, I didn't really know how to drive. I didn't tell anybody that. I had to back down the sidewalk with extras running around. And I did it like five, on the fifth take, I smashed the Lexus into the tree.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, oh my God, they're going to fire me. You know, it's like my second day.
Right.
this guy's the star. He must think I'm an idiot. And he just looked at me. He said, you don't know how to drive. I said, no, he just started laughing. And from then on, it was always, he was a good, really good guy.
Yeah.
Really good friend.
That was so sad. That
he, oh, it's terrible. It was just terrible.
It was just shocking. You know, the people go and you're like, how does it, you know, certain people are just like these forces in the world. And you're like, what, now it's just gone.
Yeah, that was shocking.
Right.
Really shocking. Yeah.
So
very young, 52, was a young guy.
Yeah, I guess he wasn't that healthy.
Yeah, but you know, I know people who are less healthy who
live forever.
Keep going.
Yeah.
I'll be honest. You know, I mean, a lot of people say, well, he didn't take care of his. I said, you know what?
Yeah,
a lot of people don't take care of themselves.
It's a genetic roll of the dice.
I don't know. You know, who knows?
Who the fuck knows?
I mean, I saw him 2 weeks before he died. He looked great. He looked happy. He looked chill. He was cool.
Well, I'm glad that he was happy.
Yeah.
So how many seasons? Like,
we did seven.
I don't know what it was like to be on that show, but like, the experience of like looking forward to that fucking show, you know, every Sunday was great.
It was good.
There was nothing like it.
It's very exciting.
There's nothing like it.
For to be a part of it was very exciting in that respect.
Now to play a junkie, you know, I mean, what was your sense memory on that? What were you leaning on that?
I'll never tell. You know, you make it whatever you want, you know, whatever you think is going to get
you. You're in New York, we all try something. You try, yeah. you know what you're doing. But, yeah. But you know, that it was an interesting character.
Oh, it was a lot of fun to play because he went all over the place.
Well, yeah, all of a sudden he's a screenwriter, then he's a dope fiend.
But he tried really hard, which I really liked about him. You know, everybody talks, I got an idea for a movie, we should do this movie, but he actually went and wrote, he really kind of, he had a lot of, heart that way.
I liked that there was a sort of, there's a weird innocent sort of striving to him.
Yeah.
But on the other side, he's just a fucking killer.
Yes, and a nut, and a jerk, and all those things. But it made it very, very fun to play.
That's great. Do you look back? I mean, is it nothing but good feelings about that whole situation?
Oh yeah.
Even if it, you know, for the rest of your life, if Christopher is going to be, you're going to be that guy.
I don't have control over that. I mean, at least it's something that's I stand behind. You know what I mean?
It's an amazing thing. Did you guys do like? I always wondered about like how like didn't they do all kinds of like other stuff like lunch boxes and shit? Did you guys get like?
They did part pinball of
that?
Machines.
Yeah, pinball machines and
not much of that.
No,
no, I wasn't in my deal.
It's wild.
Not much of those things. Yeah.
I wonder how. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. So, all right. So you had a bar for how long?
Well, my wife had a bar when I met her.
Okay.
So then I kind of worked with her there for a while, and my brother worked there, and my best friend worked there. And
was it how long?
It was really small.
Oh, okay.
Really small bar, little lounge in Chelsea. Yeah.
What was it called?
CL Rouge.
Yeah. How long was that?
We built a theater after that.
And how long did you run the theater?
We had the theater for about 7 years.
That's a pretty good run. What was the plan? Did you crap out or what?
What happened was, it was a not-for-profit, right? So it was all, we did fundraisers and we did donations. But then in 2008, when the economy collapsed, we lost all our corporate funding.
Oh.
And it became impossible.
So
that was the thing.
So you've done a lot of big parts, small parts, all kinds of movie parts. What was the Contenflos movie?
That was a Mexican film.
Yeah,
that came out this summer, and I played Mike Todd. Uh-huh. Mike Todd was a producer of Around the World in 80 Days.
Uh-huh.
Contenflos was the biggest star in the Spanish-speaking world, Mexico, and all over wherever they speak Spanish, and he starred in that movie.
Yeah,
so I don't know. They called me up and said, do you want to do it? And I said, yeah, I went to Mexico City and shot the movie. It was great.
How'd the movie do?
It did, you know, when it opened, believe it or not.
Because it wasn't meant for a Latino film.
Yeah, but this, you know, in America, there's lots of Latinos.
No, I know that. So I didn't know anything about it.
The week it opened, it had the highest.
It was all Spanish speaking, right?
Not my stuff was all in English. It had a lot of English, but mostly Spanish. But the week it opened, it was the highest gross per screen. So it didn't. It only opened on like 300 screens, but those, because all the...
Yeah.
He's very beloved. Even in America, they still watch his movies. You know?
Yeah. People have the, how do you say, Cantinflas? Is that
Cantinflas.
Cantinflas.
Which means barfly.
Yeah, he was one of the great Mexican clowns.
Yeah.
So what do you got going now? I know you've done a lot of TV shows here and there, this and that, had some good parts in movies.
I did a pilot for Amazon called Mad Dogs that they're going to, Amazon airs their pilots and then decides whether they want to do, it's a very different model. Then they decide whether they want to do it or not. It's kind of like Deliverance meets The Hangover.
Comedy, I'm guessing.
Dark comedy. It's a lot of dark shit.
It's very dark, yeah.
And it's Ben Chaplin, Steve Zahn, Billy Zane is in the pilot.
Well, that sounds exciting.
Romany Malco. Yeah, it was cool.
And
fun.
I saw you, what was that movie you played the cop in? The one with the Peter Jackson movie?
Oh, The Lovely Bones.
Yeah, that was an interesting movie.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah.
That was really fun.
What about directing a movie and writing one again?
I'm writing something now that I hope I'll direct at some point, but I'm working on a project as a writer right now that it's not kind of finalized, so I can't really talk about it, but it's adapting a really cool movie from the early 90s, a cool cult movie to a series,
Oh,
but
cool.
I'll let you know when it's final.
Is it your idea to do it?
No, somebody approached me to work on it.
Yeah,
the producer,
great, man.
And another writer. Yeah.
So you're busy.
I'm always busy, you know? I mean, I keep myself busy.
Good, man. It was great talking to you. I appreciate
Thank
you coming.
For having me. It was really, really fun.
That was
we
great.
Never get to talk like this.
It was awesome. And best of luck with everything. And tell your kid, what can I give him? Let's send you home with something.
Oh, thank you, man.
That he might enjoy. I wonder what I'll find something. Nice
right,
talking
bro.
To you, man.
Thanks.
That's our show. Isn't it great to hear from Michael? I love that guy. It's great to hear from that guy. Great to talk to him. What have I got here? Like, I went and bought something. I was on Twitter. And, you know, I follow Sennheiser, the mic place. They had a mic, like they just had this guitar amp mic. Like, it's just this little mic you put in front of your guitar amp. I think it's like a 906 or something. And I'm like, I need one of those because, like, God knows I'm a professional musician out here in my garage. But it's just, it's specifically for this. JustCoffee.coop, available at WTFpod.com. That is, it's a fairly tuned up Stratocaster. In a just a old style, very basic crybaby wah wah paddle, like I used to have when I was in high school, but didn't really know how to use it. I don't think I know how to use it right now. Boomer lives. Hey, folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they
they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me. A tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.